This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Malaria. It's one of our oldest and most widely spread diseases. It strikes as many as 200 million people per year. And science has been searching for a cure for malaria for countless generations, always hoping that some new discovery might be useful in the search. And that brings us to the work of one group of scientists in Seattle. That group has genetically modified the malaria parasite itself to train the human immune system to fight back. The researchers knocked out three genes in the parasite to create a parasite that cannot reproduce in the body, thus letting the immune system respond and attack it. And the first human trial has wrapped up, and it appears to have been a success. No one actually became ill. No one suffered any side effects except some itching from the mosquito bites used to administer the vaccine. But none of the people have been tested with real malaria yet, so we don't have that real test coming up yet. That's in the future. What's next for this approach? How close are we to a highly effective vaccine against malaria? My guest is the principal investigator on this test. Stefan Kappe is a professor and director of translational science at the Center for Infectious Disease Research in Seattle. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Malaria has been around for a long time. Why don't we have a vaccine yet?
I would say that the main reason why we don't have an effective malaria vaccine is the complexity of the parasitic organism that causes malaria. It's Plasmodium. It's a cellular parasite that is as complex as a human cell, nearly as complex as a human cell, and it undergoes these many changes when it moves from the mosquito vector to the human host. And within the human host, it has different stages of infection. It first infects your liver, and you don't feel the infection, and then it comes out of your liver after it multiplies and infects your heart cells, and that is what causes disease and potentially kills you. But every time the parasite changes, it's kind of a turncoat parasite. It changes every time. And so it has been extremely difficult to devise strategies to come up with an effective vaccine to prevent infection or prevent illness.
Now, what made your strategy successful where others have failed?
I think the overall strategy is to fight fire with fire, so to speak. And the parasite itself stimulates the immune system in a great way. But if you disable the parasite so it cannot fool the immune system, it cannot trick the immune system, and it cannot make you sick, if you weaken it to a degree that it lacks all these capabilities, but it still stimulates the immune response appropriately, that's the way to make the most efficacious malaria vaccine. Other strategies that have used individual proteins of the parasite, for example, just to point out, the parasite has over 5,000 proteins, and people in the past have tried to take individual proteins and develop them as vaccines, and that has not been very successful.
So your strategy sounds to me like what we do with a virus, like polio or something else like that. To make a vaccine, you just use a sort of weakened version of it, and the body responds.
That's exactly right. A virus, however, is a much less complex organism, so it really is a difficult task for us was to find a way to weaken the parasite appropriately. And also, traditionally, these attenuated organisms, such as polioviruses, have been attenuated by approaches that weren't really very controlled. They were passed through tissue culture, for example, or through animals, and were just weakened in the process, and then they were used as vaccines. Our approach is very designed in that we pick genes that are important for the parasite to grow in the liver initially, and we delete those genes using genetic engineering, and that renders the parasite unable to replicate after initial infection.
Now, I understand that you had 10 human subjects in this, and you yourself were part of one of the were a subject. How did you administer the malaria to the subjects?
So just to step back a little bit, so the parasite is transmitted by mosquitoes, and it sits in the salivary glands of the mosquitoes, and that's the form of the parasite that infects you. And that's actually the form of the parasite that we try to make into a vaccine by specifically removing genes that then allow the parasite, after it transitions from the mosquito to the human, to infect the liver. And so in this trial, we administered this attenuated parasite by mosquito bite. And we wanted to prove that this is completely safe, so we gave a very high dose. And in this case, a very high dose means that we gave a lot of mosquito bites. So each of us volunteers received about 200 mosquito bites carrying this attenuated parasite, weakened parasite, delivering between about 100,000 and 200,000 of those parasites effectively to the human volunteer. But after follow-up, we found that no one actually developed malaria infection. Therefore, we concluded that this is a safe approach.
Now, I guess to prove it, then you would have to follow up with giving some test subjects real malaria and see if they're resistant to the real thing.
So indeed, and we can do this. So we have what's called a controlled human malaria infection model in vaccine and drug research for malaria. So we can experimentally infect human volunteers with the real malaria parasite. And if they get the parasite in the bloodstream, we can detect it by microscopy or by polymerase chain reaction. And we can treat the infection with anti-malarial drugs. So the next step for this vaccine would be to repeatedly immunize volunteers with this vaccine and then challenge them with the real infectious parasites and see if they are not developing malaria, they would be protected. And if they are developing malaria, they are not protected, but we can safely treat them. So this is a very effective way for us to test interventions for malaria, in this case, our attenuated or weakened whole parasite vaccine. And we do this right here in Seattle, in the Westlake neighborhood at our Center for Infectious Disease Research. And we are recruiting volunteers from the Seattle area for these trials.
Is it hard to recruit people?
It is actually not very hard. I was personally surprised when we started recruiting volunteers for our effort, how many people volunteered. We have a database of over 1,000 volunteers that have already expressed interest in participating in future clinical studies. So there's a tremendous interest in Seattle to help, to participate. Many people in Seattle are very globally oriented. They are outward-looking. They understand the problems, infectious mm-hmm. disease problems of the world. Many of them have been traveling and have experienced malaria, for example, before, and if not themselves, then within their families or friends, circle of friends. So a lot of interest, a lot of excitement, actually, for our work, and we really appreciate that.
Let's say you come up with a successful vaccine and it works very well. Who's going to make the vaccine?
Yeah, that's a great question. So traditionally, vaccines, as I said, have been built on individual proteins that can be produced in bacteria, and industry pharmaceutical companies are very skilled in doing this. But this is a kind of a unique approach where we take the whole parasite. So it's not easy to manufacture such a vaccine. But there are efforts in small biotech companies to develop methods to, for example, produce this type of vaccine actually within mosquitoes and then isolate it from mosquitoes and vial it so it can be administered by syringe. Now, this sounds fairly impractical, but when you consider how vaccines have been made in the past, for example, in eggs, it's actually not so unreasonable to think that we cannot do it in mosquitoes. And we are also developing cell culture, tissue culture models where we can actually manufacture this type of vaccine, this whole parasite vaccine, in a culture dish.
Is there enough money to be made in this? You know, drug companies, just they want the big victory, the big bucks here. Is there enough money to be made in this vaccine that big drug companies might be interested, or can you get away with the smaller companies?
I think in the end, it is important that large pharmaceutical companies step up to the plate and really help with this development effort. We are talking about a parasitic infection that makes over 200 million people sick each year and kills over 500,000 people. So I do hope that pharmaceutical companies will carry that responsibility to ultimately help us to produce such a vaccine. But in terms of economy of this vaccine, I think there is a market there for travelers and people traveling to malaria-endemic areas. From Western Europe and from the United States, there's millions of people traveling to malaria endemic areas each year. So there's a market for a vaccine, therefore what we call a traveler's vaccine. But of course, the vaccine is needed most by those directly affected by malaria every day. And here it becomes a little bit more difficult to think about the economy and the economy of this vaccine development. And we do hope that, of course, that government and organizations such as the Gates Foundation will step in and participate in developing this vaccine.
Now, I understand there's already one vaccine that's advanced through clinical trials and will be used in a pilot program in parts of Africa. How does your vaccine compare to that? Why do we need another one?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this vaccine that you are referring to is a vaccine that is built, as I pointed out before, on these individual proteins. So it's one protein of the parasite. And this vaccine has undergone extensive clinical testing and has been tested in what we call phase three. So these are late stage clinical trials in Africa and has about 30% efficacy. There's a lot of debate how this efficacy is calculated and so on and so forth, but let's say it's about 30%. So we and others believe that that is not yet sufficient to really contribute significantly to eradication and elimination and eradication of malaria with a vaccine. So we have to get better than 30%. Mm-hmm. And we hope with our approach we can get to 80% plus. And there's good evidence that we can reach that.
And give us a timeline of how this might play out.
Yeah, timelines are always difficult to predict, but I would say in the best case scenario, with all the funding in place and secured to bring this through clinical development, I would say an 8 to 10 year timeline is realistic.
Is CRISPR going to help you anywhere?
That's a great question. So this parasite strain that we have engineered by deletion of three genes that cause a parasite to stop development in the liver has been done by traditional methods. And this has taken a long time and was very cumbersome. Now with CRISPR, it will be so much accelerated. And we are already creating the next generation of attenuated strains or weakened strains using CRISPR technology. It will make a big difference.
How many bites do your volunteers, you said, got 200 bites? Are you still scratching from?
I am not scratching any longer. It has been a fun experience, actually, sitting there with the volunteers and talking to them about the work. And they were so excited to do it. Of course, they were itching, and I myself was itching for a little while after those bites, but it was not as bad as everyone thought. And everyone said they would be happy to come back and participate again. So I think it sounds strange, but it's actually a great experience.
Well, you know, if you're looking for volunteers, there's no faster way to get them than come on our show, because we have 2 million listeners, and I hope you're not flooded. Well, I don't know. Actually, maybe that you should be flooded with more phone calls to get volunteers. So,
yeah, I would appreciate that. Everyone is welcome, and it's a great
effort. How do they reach you if they want to volunteer?
They can go to our website at cidresearch.org, and they will find a link to our clinical trial center, and they can sign up right there.
All right, there you have it, our good deed for the weekend. Thank you very much. Good luck to you, Dr. Kappa.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Dr. Stefan Kappa, professor and director of translational science at the Center for Infectious Disease Research in Seattle, Washington. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to look at something really cool, fossilized teeth and eggs for dinosaurs. Yeah, they could tell us about dinosaur behavior. It's some interesting new research on fossilized dinosaur eggs. Always a popular subject, so stay with us. We'll be right back after the break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You remember that scene from Jurassic Park where the baby raptor hatches from the egg?
Come on, then. There you are. There you are.
Yeah, we all know how that turned out. Not so good. But how much do we really know about dino eggs or how they reproduced? What were their eggs like? What can this tell us about how dinosaurs lived? A study out this week in the journal Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences tackled those questions, and my next guest is the lead author on that study. Gregory Erickson is professor of anatomy and vertebrate paleobiology at Florida State University in Tallahassee. He joins us by Skype. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, hi. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're quite welcome. Let's talk about your study. You looked at dinosaur hatchlings and embryos still in the egg. How were you able to get your hands on those? How are they preserved?
Yeah, well, these are some of the rarest fossils in the world. We find pieces of dinosaur egg all over the Badlands. Very rarely do we find a whole egg. Once in a while, we find a whole egg that actually has some bones in it. And in this case, the eggs were broken a little bit. We could see the skeletons in there. And I gained access through my colleague Darla Zelenitsky at the University of Calgary and Mark Norell at the American Museum of Natural History. Each of them had some dinosaur embryos that I could look at.
And tell us what exactly you learned from all of this.
Well, what we did is we cut open some of the embryonic teeth, and within teeth you'll find daily growth lines called von Ebner incremental lines, and you can count them up just like tree rings, except they're daily. And so we counted those up, and we figured out how long these animals were incubating in the egg. And what we found was that the smallest dinosaurs took about 3 months to incubate their eggs, and these giant hepacosaur eggs, these are ridiculous. They look like volleyballs. Those eggs were hatching out in about 6 months.
So you have to incubate this egg for 6 months? Does that tell us something about the mothering of a dinosaur?
It has a lot of ramifications for understanding life history of dinosaurs. It meant that the eggs were exposed to predators and stochastic events such as droughts and flooding and these sorts of things for long periods of time. And also some of the predatory dinosaurs, and it's also thought that maybe these duckbill dinosaurs, which is one of the animals we studied, were actually brooding their eggs. So the parents would have been exposed to predators and starvation for long periods of time.
You know, we've always heard now, and it's sort of become a rote now, that dinosaurs are related to birds, but That's not an incubation time for a bird, is it?
No, we were actually pretty stunned by what we found. Birds are dinosaurs, so it was just assumed that the extremely rapid incubation periods you see for birds would be seen in the dinosaurs. But instead, we found they're more like reptiles, which they take almost twice as long to cook their eggs, so to speak. The way I liken it is birds are dinosaurs, but dinosaurs are not birds.
Oh, I like that. I like that. I'll make
and I mean that in the sense of their biology, not the sense they're not related.
But and dinosaurs are born with a full set of teeth, right?
Yeah, they are. Yeah, they hatched out ready to go. In fact, what's really interesting about these dinosaurs is they were literally chewing, in the egg. They were literally using their teeth, getting them ready for when they hatched out, so they'd be ready to, you know, go out and find some plant forage.
And we know birds, rare teeth are as rare as hen's teeth, that sort of thing for birds. So that's another difference here we have between dinosaurs and birds, at least in this stage of the dinosaur life.
Yeah, well, the earliest birds had teeth, and actually our data suggests that maybe some of the earliest birds had very slow incubation as well, and that the modern rapid incubation, birds just explosively reproduce and hatch out, so to speak, probably evolved in the avian lineage, probably in the Cretaceous and just before the KPG cataclysm.
Wow. Were dinosaur eggs similar to bird eggs, or are they thicker and more leathery like the reptile eggs? You're talking about a sort of an on the cusp here.
They seem to be a lot more like birds' eggs. That's why we're finding them so often preserved. So they reptiles, even crocodilians, although they have calcified eggs, they're somewhat leathery.
Mm-hmm. And chicken eggs have an oval shape, but some dinosaur eggs, I was looking at some at the American Museum of Natural History last week, they seem to be more round and symmetrical. Why is that?
Well, no one really knows. There's different egg shapes. Some of it has to do with how strong the egg is in terms of the load of sediment on it and these sorts of things, and also just how they compact the eggs, and the elongated eggs can be laid and sort of fall out in certain patterns that somehow would have benefited their development. The shapes of dinosaur eggs are quite variable, as you say. The smallest eggs we studied look like potatoes, and the big ones we looked at look like volleyballs. The very largest eggs look like, I don't know how to explain it, like kind of like a French roll, so to speak.
Would the shape and the size of the eggs have anything to do, and the incubation time it takes to, have anything to do in the role that played, why they died out?
Well, not so much the shape, but we think that the slow incubation we found with dinosaurs is an important piece to the puzzle to understand their extinction. Dinosaurs were basically caught holding some bad cards, a dead man's hand, so to speak, when the asteroid hit. This is a time when all the flora of the world got knocked back, and there was very little sustenance. And we think that, as near as we can tell, dinosaurs were endothermic, so they're profligate consumers of energy, required a lot of resources to grow up. Some of my growth curve work has shown that all dinosaurs took a year or more to sexually mature, so they had very slow generation times. And then you throw in this other black ace, and it basically says that they, even once they did lay their eggs, they took an enormous amount of time to hatch out. And these are not attributes that are conducive for surviving an environment that doesn't have much energy or much sustenance. On top of it, these are animals that are not going to repopulate the world very quickly and be able to adapt to fill vacated niche space. And we think that the amphibians, the reptiles, the mammals, and the birds that survived were basically just the better competitors, and this had something to do with the dinosaur extinction.
Well, birds lay eggs quite often. How often did dinosaurs lay an egg, so to speak?
Well, we really don't know that. We would assume on an annual basis, but that's just another piece of the puzzle we need to figure out.
All right. Thank you very much for sharing this information with us, Gregory.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is an honor. Thank you.
You're quite welcome. Dr. Gregory Erickson, Professor of Anatomy and Vertebrate Paleobiology, Florida State University in Tallahassee. And you can see photos of these fossilized dinosaur hatchlings. They're up on our website at sciencefriday.com/dinoegg.
Why are we still moving towards it?
We caught the tractor and it's pulling us in.
There's got to be something you can do.
There's nothing I can do about it, kid. I'm full power. I'm going to have to shut down. You're not going to get me without a fight.
That sound should be familiar to you. Star Wars fans, there's nothing that can be done once you've been targeted by a tractor beam, that piece of sci-fi technology that trapped the Millennial Falcon in Star Wars. Or perhaps you're more familiar with it from the popular TV series Star Trek. Yeah, they always use tractor beams there. It is an iconic feature of the science fiction genre. But until recently, and I'm saying until recently, it was just fiction. I'm saying recently because my next guest not only figured out a way to make the tractor beam real, but now he's made it easy enough for you or anyone to build one. That's right. You could be living out your own Star Wars fantasy very soon. Azir Marzo is a research associate at the University of Bristol, and he joins us via Skype. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you. Tell us, so we've all seen it on TV, in the movies. How does your tractor beam actually work?
Basically, a tractor beam is a beam that can attract an object towards the source. And in the case of sound, that's very hard because if you just blast sound into a particle, the particle will be pushed away. And what you want to do is to attract the particle towards the object. So in order to do so, you need to model the beam that you are generating so that when it reaches the particle, it surrounds the particle. It becomes hollow where the particle is, and you surround the particle with high intensity.
So you're using sound waves to levitate the particle?
Exactly. Previously, some people had used lasers to create some sort of tractor beam. But the problem with light is that it carries very little momentum in terms of mechanical. So if you want to push particles with lasers, it's very hard. But sound, on the contrary, carries a lot of momentum.
And how much weight can your tractor beam lift? How big an object?
Well, when I said a lot of momentum, it's compared to the laser. Our objects that we levitate now, they are 3 millimeter diameter spheres made of expanded polystyrene. But with more powerful systems, we have levitated liquids, flies, and other biological samples.
Wow. And you first created your tractor beam back in 2015. And now you have this 3D printed version. How did you modify it? How did you come up with this 3D printed version?
The thing is that when we created the first acoustic tractor beam, it was a very complex system. It had 64 speakers, and each speaker had its own amplifier and its own signal generator. So we decided that if we wanted this acoustic tractor beam to become like a widespread technology, we should make a simpler version. And we made a 3D printed version. And basically, all these electronic signals, they become simplified. They are like electronic delays. So what we do is we generate only one electric signal. What we put the delays with the 3D printed structure. The 3D printed structure is just like a structure made of different tubes of different lengths, and you introduce the delays with these tubes.
Hmm. And what would you have to do to change it to work on bigger things?
First, if you want to levitate denser objects, you need to apply more power. But bigger objects is a more challenging thing to achieve, just because the wavelength, or at least with the techniques that we have, the wavelength determines the maximum size of the object. You cannot levitate anything bigger than half the wavelength. In our case, 40 kilohertz is the frequency that we use. That's 8 millimeters wavelength. So we cannot levitate anything bigger than 4 millimeters. So with the techniques that we have, we should reduce the frequency. And we cannot reduce it more than 20 kilohertz because we will reach the audible spectrum, and that will be kind of painful. But yeah, we are researching about how to surpass this threshold, how we can levitate objects that are bigger than half the wavelength.
It sure sounds like fun to play around with, but do you have a practical use for it yet?
Yeah, with the current version, we have some applications for levitating samples that you want to inspect visually. For instance, if you are doing blood analysis with Raman spectroscopy, which is basically shining a laser into the blood, and then you analyze the scatter light. So if you can levitate the droplet of blood, all the reflections that you get, they are from the sample.
Hmm. Is it possible to, I've looked on your website, looked at your research. In fact, it's up on our website at sciencefriday.com/beam. People have been reacting to this. They're saying, like, maybe in medicine you could use it. Maybe you could move kidney stones around or other particles in the body. Is that possible?
Exactly. When everyone asks, oh, can you levitate bigger objects? I have to say, for me, the best application is in medicine, levitating smaller objects that are inside your body. And that's possible because sound travels even better through your body than through air, because you pretty much your body is like water.
Wow. Talking with Azir Marzo, Research Associate at the University of Bristol on Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Okay, Azir, now where do you go from now with this?
Now, what we are going to do is, as I said, make more powerful versions, but for me the most important thing is to make it work in the human body. Of course, we don't have the expertise, neither the time, neither the, basically, all the legitimate ways of doing experiments with humans, but we will do our tests with phantoms, with a fake tissue that emulates human bodies, and we will try to levitate particles inside fake human bodies.
Well, now that you've sort of opened this up to the public by allowing anybody to 3D print it, what other parts do you need to do it? You need a sound generating piece, right? Plus, when you open it up to the public, I imagine people will come up with different things that they can do with it, maybe even improve it.
That's for me the best thing, like releasing it for the public, making it as easy as possible. And then I'm sure the maker community, other colleagues, maybe just the general public, people at school, they will create their own applications.
And what is the toughest thing you need to figure out? Is it easy to make the sound producing part? You talked about making the objects on 3D printing, but there's got to be electronics and things you have to make that you can't 3D print.
Exactly, but all the electronics, they are very simple because we only need one electric signal. The delays, all these phases, all these complicated phases, they are introduced by the 3D printed structure. And we have made sure that all the components are available in mainstream sites like Amazon or Dielectrem.
So you're a fan of the sci-fi genre. What attracted you, so to speak, to the tractor beam research?
I think the levitation, when you see levitation in movies, not only the tractor beam, but maybe a character that is manipulating all the pieces in the air and assembling them, I think that's what really attracted me towards levitation.
Mm-hmm. And so how old were you when you started working on this?
How old I was? 28. It was like 2 years ago, now I'm 30.
And is this something you can pursue as a career, just this one project?
I think I have more projects related to levitation, but no, now I'm trying to reach other fields. I think I would get too enclosed if I just focus on acoustic levitation. But certainly there is still lots of applications to explore.
And you still have that limit of the size of the wavelength of the sound wave that you're going to use, that you have to use.
Sure, we are working on that, and I'm pretty sure that in a couple of months or so, we will have results to publish about how to beat this limit, because it's something that everyone asks, how we can levitate bigger objects, and I said, the wavelength.
Let me see if I can get a phone call before we have to leave. Let's go to Scott in California. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Ira, how are you doing?
Hey there, go ahead.
Hey, I just got a quick question. I was wondering if they could use that to levitate dust in your house, and then have a vacuum cleaner that would be hooked up to it so you could suck all the dust off of all the objects that it collects on.
That's a great... See that, Azir? People are already asking questions.
I think it's a fantastic idea. I was thinking about it. I was thinking about the Roomba. Everyone knows the Roomba. And I said, maybe it's cool if you attach these kind of levitators, and what it will do, it will lift the particles, the dust from the surface, and just gather all of it together. And actually, today I have received an email from some guys that work with drugs, and they need to inspect fine powders. And to deattach powders from the surface, they were interested in using these tractor beams. So yeah, it's a very good idea.
Wow, thank you. That sounds exciting, Azir. Thank you very much for taking time to be with us, and good luck to you. Check back
Thanks
in.
To you. It has been my pleasure.
My pleasure, too. Azir Marzo, Research Associate at the University of Bristol. We're going to take a break, and afterwards we're going to talk to two scientists who are working on experiments that have been running, quite a while. We're talking decades. Some experiments going on for centuries. We'll talk about why, how patient can you be after the break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Science, as you know, is a process. Careful, meticulous observations, repeating experiments, teasing out patterns, and all of this takes time and dedication. But in this era of on-demand results and the rush to publish, research can often be designed for quick turnarounds. But this is not nature's timescale. What can we learn when we let science take its time? Well, today we make a case for slow science, experiments that unfold across decades, even centuries. Presented for your consideration, a study that has been going on for 140 years and another that is in its 66,000th generation. My next guests are stewards of those studies. Frank Tulewski is professor of plant biology and curator of the W.J. Beal Botanical Garden at Michigan State University in East Lansing, Michigan. Richard Lenski is a professor of microbiology and molecular genetics, also out of Michigan State University. Welcome to Science Friday.
Eric, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you, and Happy New Year to you.
What's going on in East Lansing that you guys are all working on this? You know each other? Hang out at all?
Well, we certainly see each other around the campus, attending seminars, lecturing.
Okay.
That's right.
That's good. Okay. Let me ask you, Frank, first. You oversee a seed germination project that was started, back in 1879? Tell us about that.
That's correct. Professor William James Beal, who came here to Michigan State in 1870, was very interested in working with farmers and addressing farmer questions and some very basic and applied botanical questions related to agriculture and plants in general. And I think one of the big questions that was of the time was, I go out there and I plow up my field as a farmer and I sow my seeds and these pesky weeds come up and they are growing all over the place and I go out there with my hoe. A long row to hose, the terminology came from that, physically removing the weeds and yanking them out. It's a lot of work. They didn't have herbicides back then or ways to control weeds. And, well, these pesky weeds, when can we expect them to start declining in population, and when can we start seeing a little bit less work in our fields? And so that was a question directly related to how long can seeds remain viable in the soil, or what we refer to as the seed bank. Mm-hmm. So Professor Beal designed this experiment to see how long different types of seeds would remain viable within the soil.
So what was the experiment? What did he actually do?
Well, he started out with 20 bottles. And on those 20 bottles, he would insert a sandy mix. So he had some sand on his bench there. And in the sand, he would mix in 21 species of different seeds, weed seeds and more common plant seeds. And he would count out 50 seeds of each of the particular species and mix them into the sand and fill the bottle, do that 20 times, and then he buried the bottles here upside down at a slight angle on the grounds of Michigan State University. And the intent was that every 5 years, excavate a bottle, shake the sandy seed mix out, and see what would germinate.
And you've been doing that for him?
Well, I'm very honored to be able to step in his shoes, so to speak, in the year 2000 with Dr. Jan Zavart. We were the next generation of scientists to pick up the mantle and go out there, excavate, remove a bottle, and continue the experiment.
In that 2000, I understand that you unearthed the bottles in the middle of the night. Was there method to that madness there?
Yeah, actually, there's two reasons for that. I think the main scientific reason is that many seeds that are buried in the seed bank receive environmental triggers to germinate, and one of the key environmental signals to germinate is light, so sunlight or any other kind of light. And so when we excavate the bottles, we end up exposing the ends of several of the bottles, and so we don't want to unnecessarily trigger a germination event in a bottle prior to its removal. The other aspect is we don't like to attract attention to ourselves. Working in the dark of night on campus before sunup, it's a pretty quiet time on campus. And so DPPS, our campus police department, know we're out there, and hopefully that's all it knows we're out there.
Well, I have to ask you the $64 question. Did the seeds germinate? I mean, they've been buried since 1879.
Well, yeah, this is what's so exciting, is that we don't know what the results are going to be until they actually start to germinate. And so within, about 7 days after we had taken the soil, the sandy soil, out of the bottle and spread it out onto a sterile soil mixed surface in the growth chamber, we were very excited to see some little green plants begin to germinate, and we nurtured those along. And found out that we had, I believe it was 24 Verbascum blattaria, the moth mullein plants, germinate. which is an amazing germination rate after being buried in the ground for 120 years. That's close to a 50% germination rate. And one single plant of what we call cheeses, Malva rotundifolia, germinated. And so we're very excited about that. That's a plant that has not consistently shown up in the experiment. But fortunately, going back to Beale's meticulous notes on the subject, we found out that those seeds may not have been viable when they were put in the experiment in the beginning of the study.
So you've read through Dr. Beale's notebooks and his original notes. Do you have any sense of how Victorian science was different than how we do research today?
Well, unfortunately, I don't have his original notebooks. They were unfortunately lost in a garage fire many decades ago, but we do have his publications, and that's what's so important about any scientific publication in a peer-reviewed journal is having access for future generations to pull that information out. And so, you know, being able to read his original words that he wrote and published is very inspiring and is very helpful because, again, going back to how the original experiment was designed and set out and implemented and what were the results he found, and Professor Beale was very meticulous as an observer. He always taught his students, you know, be keen observers of the world around you. Keep squinting. Keep looking at those things. And he practiced what he preached. And so when he looked at these seeds coming out of the bottles, when he looked at the various experiments that he did, he took meticulous notes and recorded those notes and reported those notes in the published literature.
Now, let's change the subject to something totally different. Richard Lenski, you started your project in 1988 growing colonies of E. coli. Why did you want to do this? And what's the original question?
So there were several questions, but I'd say the key question that really motivated me on this experiment was I've just always been fascinated about the tension between luck and skill in the games we play. And in evolution, that takes the form of natural selection, which is if you have two different genotypes and one reproduces faster than the other, it should win. But genotypes arise by random mutations. And so there's this luck of the mutations and then the competition between the organisms. And I wanted to sort of ask the question, if I could set up these 12 replicate populations of E. coli, all started from the same ancestor, would they evolve along similar or different paths from one another?
And the answer is?
The answer is it's not a very well-posed question, so the excitement in the work has been we've seen some really dramatic examples of similarities between the populations where they're doing a lot of things quite similar to one another. All of the 12 populations are making cells that not only grow much faster than their ancestor, but that are much bigger cells. But we've also seen cases where one population goes off and does something completely different from another population. So we're using it as an open-ended experiment to look at this tension between the reproducibility and the randomness of evolution.
You know, I'm looking in my mind and thinking of stacks and stacks of Petri dishes here. Or some glassware with all kinds of colonies inside. Very far off from what I'm looking at?
So the experiment itself is actually quite a small experiment. There are 12 little flasks that only hold a few ounces of liquid each. And every day, so our experiment is, compared to the one that Frank just told you about, our experiment's a baby. It's only going to have its 29th birthday next year. But unlike that experiment, we do something every day. Somebody in the lab takes 1% of each population of the bacteria and transfers it into fresh media. So every day, the bacteria have about seven generations of growth. Now, one of the neat things, it's a little bit like the seed bank that Frank talked about, one of the really neat things with bacteria is we can freeze them away at minus 80 degrees Celsius. So we put them in deep freezers periodically, and we now have several freezers full of samples from different periods along our experiment. And what we can do is we can do experiments where we, for example, compete the bacteria from later generation against their very own ancestors. So one of the things we see, if your listeners take away nothing else, is we can see the Darwinian process of adaptation by natural selection. These random mutations, most of which are neutral or many of which are deleterious to the organisms, natural selection is this systematic advantage that accrues to those that are reproducing faster than other genotypes in this very simple laboratory environment that we give them. So the stacks of Petri dishes come when we do these competition experiments. We need certain ways of counting the bacteria and telling apart which ones are the ancestral bacteria, which ones are the evolved bacteria. So we have little tricks with Petri dishes and colors of colonies that will allow us to tell them apart.
Let me ask both of you, I mean, don't you face a crisis of sort of creating a priesthood of scientists who will take over when you're retiring, to continue these experiments?
So I very much am, I don't know about a priesthood, but I am very much looking forward to the possibility that my experiment might continue as long as Professor Beal's. So as I said, it's about a quarter as old at this point. There are many people who would be interested in continuing the experiment. I'd like to pass it on while I'm still relatively young and able to help plan its future. I think it's been an experiment that's yielded a lot of interesting results, a lot of surprises along the way, and I very much hope it can continue really into perpetuity.
Because you know that budgets get cut at universities, when they start to cut budgets, science budgets get cut usually the first sometimes. I mean, you know, isn't it possible we might have to ship it off to another university, maybe in a cold climate like they have in Michigan, so you don't have to refrigerate as much?
I think the freezers are the least of our problems, although we always worry about power outages and that kind of stuff. But, you know, maybe one of your listeners has a $2 or $3 million extra they'd like to spare, because that's all, you know, all it needs is a small endowment in this case to keep the experiment going into perpetuity, because the work is pretty simple. And yet the experiment, I call it the experiment that keeps on giving, because it just keeps the bacteria are creative, the students are creative, new technologies come along. So when I started the experiment, not a single bacterial genome had been sequenced. And recently we published a paper where we sequenced hundreds of complete genomes of the E. coli bacteria out of this one experiment. So the new technologies are just making old experiments incredibly exciting.
Now, Frank, you're a researcher and also a curator. And once a scientist is gone, so is their collection. Don't you have the same worries here?
Well, that's a really good question. And actually, we have a way of dealing with that here at Michigan State University. We have what's referred to as the Collections Council. And so the Collections Council are all the curators of all the variety of collections, natural history collections, and cultural collections at the university. And we provide a way of governance, a loose governance, but a way of trying to facilitate continuity between collections. And anytime that you have a collection and you have a curatorial staff or a curator involved with that collection, you have a collections policy. And that collections policy involves what to do with a collection if that collection no longer has a home at a particular institution. So what we refer to as deaccessioning. Excuse me. And so if we have to lose a collection, it should never end up into a dumpster someplace. And we've actually had a few instances in the past where maybe a collection without a curator and without a faculty position being hired to fulfill that particular need, that collection is important enough and it needs to be preserved. And so maybe it'll be shipped to another institution, a sister institution. I believe we sent some fossil specimens to the Chicago Field Museum a few years ago as a way of preserving that, and along with all the information. So there is that. There is always that possibility. I think in the case of the Beal Botanical Garden, which I'm the curator of, we have a very long history for the garden. It's very well known, very prestigious. Professor Beal's legacy is very well respected here at Michigan State. And so I think the garden in that existence and its continued contribution, the fact that we are still heavily engaged in research and teaching.
I have to interrupt you and let everybody know that this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flato talking with Frank Dolewski and Richard Lenski. I didn't mean to interrupt you. You're hoping that they continue in their tradition.
Yeah, and I think, you know, to kind of answer your question from the Beal seed experiment earlier about funding, I mean, one of the things that we're very fortunate and Rich kind of mentioned is that, you know, the bottles sit in the soil for 20 years now. It originally was 5 years. It got extended to 10 years. Now we're doing it every 20 years. We have five more bottles. So after 2020, we'll have four more bottles. But there's not a lot of maintenance necessary. You dig a bottle up, you analyze it, you wait 20 years. But as Rich mentioned, certainly when you think back to the time of Professor Beal, you know, they didn't have any idea what DNA was. I don't think DNA even was on anybody's radar as a chemical at that point in time, let alone the genetic material, the genetic information. And now that we have this information, and now that we have the advanced technologies to sequence, one of the exciting things with these old experiments is, can we actually utilize modern technology? And we will use modern technology to advance our knowledge of this legacy study. And so, for instance, when we think about seeds buried in the soil, you basically have what we can refer to as a genetic reservoir. And so these are a trapped genetic reservoir from 140 years when we opened the bottle up in 2020. How does that population vary to an existing population in Michigan today? And can we see significant changes and adaptations that maybe the populations today that have been around for 140 years have made? So bringing in new faculty, I wouldn't call them priests. We're doing science. It is an honor to be a part of that, and I'm sure that the people who come and replace us will feel that way as well. But it is also there's also stewardship that's so important to make sure that these experiments are maintaining and the connectivity, continuity is maintained.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wish you both luck, and if you find those few millions, maybe you can send a few our direction, because you know, we can all use the research. I'll just my last comment. It's interesting also, I don't have much time to talk about it, that in this age of computer simulation, you're actually still working hands-on with the actual materials themselves and not having computer-generated models of what might happen. You get down there and look at a seed that's 140 years old. Frank Tulusky, professor of plant biology and the curator of the W.J. Beal Botanical Garden at Michigan State University in East Lansing. Richard Lenski, professor of microbiology and molecular genetics, also at Michigan State University. Happy to introduce you to one another, and go have a beer on us. B.J. Lederman, compose our theme music. Our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you'd like to write us, yes, send your letters the classic way. Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. You can email us, scifry@sciencefriday.com. And also, we have all kinds of stuff up on our website at sciencefriday.com and our educational materials. And, of course, we're on Twitter and Facebook, having a good time all week. Every day is Friday with us. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.